portion of a liturgy in the little booklet I'm passing out to you. It's a resource that you should know about, particularly if you're interested in farm and food concerns. It is put together, was put together a couple years ago by Joe Bash, whom some of you have gotten to know here. You may take this copy along home with you. You are free to reproduce it in your local church or anywhere else. You cannot get quantity copies of it, however, from the people who produced it. We don't have them in quantity. It was done by the ALC's World Hunger Program, and what it seeks to do is to lift up the biblical material dealing with farming, farm people, the life of agriculture, and the food needs of the world. And it follows the sequence of food production and harvesting and distribution, marketing, from the winter through the fall and into another winter, the cycle of growing and distributing food. It is celebrative. We will use a portion of day 4, which is right in the middle of the booklet, the day of growing. We are still, in most parts of the United States, at least in the growing season, at least for some crops, the pre-harvest time. We will use the portion that begins halfway down page 8, the Fellowship of Farm Folk Working, and we will go through the middle of page 9, the Kinship with Nature. And I would ask that that you all read together the three prayers on page 8. We'll do those in unison. And then at the top of page 9, I will read the leader portion and you respond with the response indicated for all, and then we will pray together the Kinship with Nature. This emphasizes the theme of the people who work the land and the relationship among those who own land and those who work land but are not owners of the land. So let us begin. Let these hard days of helping plants live be an occasion for helping each other live. As we serve the ground and its fruits, let us serve each other also. Let not the length of our tiredness overshadow our relation in the family and among fellow workers. Lord, it is a different time, and farming has become a huge enterprise. The old ways seem to be going. Some are owners and others tenants. Prevent such divisions from separating us from each other, lest management of the farm become only a manipulation of those who must be hired. Let not human hands become mere farm implements. Lord Jesus Christ, who came as a migrant wandering in a hostile land, help us to see your face in the lowliest servant of the ground. From plagues of insects and from drought,
good Lord, hear us.
From lightning and hailstorms,
good Lord, hear us.
From all calamity by scorching heat or too much rain,
good Lord, hear us.
In the time of our depressions,
help us, good Lord.
In the times of our prosperity,
help us, good Lord.
Praise the Lord of growing things, praise him from the ground. Grain and pigs and tasseled corn, praise with murmuring sound. Praise him, weeds and muscled arms, tractors, days and nights. Praise him, all you fields and farms, praise God in the heights. Thank you. Our subject matter this morning is a theology of the land. My name is Charles Lutz. I am the coordinator of the World Hunger Program of the American Lutheran Church. I work out of an office in Minneapolis. And among other things, that means that I have become involved with following U.S. farm issues and the questions of how we use the land, particularly agricultural land, in the United States. The economics of farming, the plight of family farmers, and all of that has become a part of my responsibility. I am not an expert on it, I must say. I've relied heavily for this morning's presentation on three books, and I want to mention those to you, in addition to the Bible, particularly the Old Testament portions of the Scripture, which form the basis of the land theology of Jewish and Christian people. The other three books, in addition to the Scriptures, are The Land by Walter Brueggemann, Walter Brueggemann has been here at Holden in the recent past, and if you are interested in more scholarly and in-depth approach to the subject, you might want to pull out the Brueggemann tapes and listen to them. He has done what is probably the most significant recent academic work on the land, the biblical theology of the land. The book is published by Fortress Press of the LCA, and it's appeared within just the last few years. Walter is a teacher at Eden Seminary in St. Louis of the United Church of Christ. Another book that I'm drawing from is The Unsettling of America, Culture and Agriculture by Wendell Berry. This book, I understand, was used also at Holden in the past, I think in the winter program this past year, as a special study. The book deals with the problem we're having in the United States of not settling the land, but unsettling the land, the removal of people from the land, which is one way of talking about the increase in farm size and the decrease in farm population. Wendell Berry is a farmer who is also something of a poet, and I think this is a rather poetic treatment of some of the issues that we'll be talking about this morning, The Unsettling of America. The third book is one for which I had direct responsibility. Farming the Lord's Land is a collection of essays on the style of farming in the United States and the structure of farming in the United States from a Christian ethical perspective, trying to relate the biblical material about the land, the use of the land, the management of the land, the stewardship of the land to the way we farm, all in the context of global food needs. I wrote two chapters and got eight other people to write eight additional chapters that deal with various aspects of the ethical questions surrounding the way we farm in the United States. Farming the Lord's Land, Christian Perspectives on American Agriculture. All three of these books in paperback are available in the Holden bookstore. Now, let me tell you what I propose to do in the next hour, and with you, explore broadly two things. The biblical theology of the land first. What are the main biblical themes about the land? Primarily for the people of Israel as they come into the land of promise, but by extension, the understanding of the land which the Bible has for all peoples and for all times. There are some connections that we can make today with that. But we'll begin with the biblical concepts or themes surrounding the land. Then secondly, what are some of the problems faced by agriculture in America, in North America, in the United States, today? And what are some of the public policy options we might consider for dealing with those problems? First, three broad themes related to the land from the scriptures. Land as a gift in covenant. Land as belonging to God, not to people. The ultimate owner of the land is not human beings, but God, the Creator. And land as an arena for justice and freedom. I'll be sharing some biblical material and with direct quotation, and I'll also be referring to some things. I'll try to remember to give you the passages in case you want to note them for later reference. First, the people of God, biblically viewed, are people of the land. The land is theirs as a gift. It is not something they earn or merit or have a right to claim. It is theirs as a gift. So that the land in the scriptures is a symbol of radical grace. The land is given by God to the people solely because he chooses to do that. Not because they have any claim to it or any right to it or have earned the possession of the land. One Deuteronomy passage which makes that clear is Deuteronomy 6, verses 10 to 12. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give you with great and goodly cities, which you did not build, and houses full of all good things, which you did not fill, and cisterns hewn out, which you did not hew, and vineyards and olive trees, which you did not plant. And when you eat and are full, then take heed, lest you forget the Lord, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. in our time, in our lifetime, there has been an example of that, and it involves this very land, where it's a difficult problem for me. It's a difficult problem, I think, for most people, and I don't have an answer to it, finally, but I'll just refer to it, the occupation of this land by the people, by the Jewish people since World War II.
That wasn't an empty land.
That's right. Nor was it empty when the original people of Israel came into it, and when they believed that God was leading them there. All of these cisterns that were hewn and cities that were filled, that was done by other people. And I'm sure those other people had some very major problems with that. And they had gods too, you know. And it was one god against other gods as they saw it. Just as today the Palestinian people have major problems with the claim of the Jews to have a right to the land of Israel. That's a problem. That's not really our subject this morning, but it's there in the background of all of this. And I think we need to keep it in mind and be sensitive to it. And it's also related to the question of, is the biblical material, the biblical story today about the promised land intended for the Jewish people today in the way that it was for the people of Israel in, you know, three or 4,000 years earlier? Yes.
He's still living
it. Yeah. Well, that's good to keep in mind in the background here. Because I don't think it looked like radical grace to the people who occupied the land when the Israelites came in, the Canaanites. Yeah, it didn't look like grace to them.
About the same thing happened with the Indians, for instance.
Exactly. Very good. I want to come to that later, but that's the native people here. In fact, a lot of our ancestors who came from Europe used biblical images to justify our taking this land, that God was leading us here to take this land as ours. This was the promised land. We used that kind of language. It's still around in our talk. Well, I don't think it looks quite the same to the Indians, you know, to the native peoples.
But when we think about it, the Indian didn't pay for the land either.
But the Indians claim to this day that they view the land in a more biblical way than we do, in terms of it belonging to everybody and not fenced off for private possession. We'll come to that theme too in a minute. Just as food in the wilderness, I'm going back to this theme of grace now, just as food in the wilderness during the 40 years of wandering is an absolute gift. They did not grow the food. It was given. It was provided. Manna, quail, water even was provided as a gift. So now the land is provided as a gift. But the land is less precarious than the manna and quail and water in the wilderness. It is talked about as a land that is flowing with milk and honey, almost like it's there for the taking. You don't have to work for it. Great contrast with Egypt, which was a land that also produced food for the Israelites, but was a land of bondage. This is a land of giftness, of promise, of freedom, of liberation. Let me read a passage from Deuteronomy 11, verses 10 to 12. For the land which you are entering to take possession of is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and watered it with your feet, like a garden of vegetables. But the land which you are going over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water by the rain from heaven. You don't have to work to water it. It gets watered automatically by the God of the heavens. It is a land which the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord your God are always upon it from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. So that contrast with the land you have left and the wilderness land you have been in for 40 years is made. Now, there's always a temptation to the people. It's talked about directly, and it's seen in how they live out their lives in the new land. The temptation is to forget the covenant. And part of that forgetting is to forget that the land is a gift. It becomes a right, something they claim as their possession, rather than a gift. To forget the insecurity of the wilderness. And they're reminded continually to remember how it was in the wilderness and to remember how it was in Egypt. They are tempted to forget remembering. The great crime or sin is to forget to remember, to fail to remember. So a chief resource of the people in the land is memory. Memory itself is a part of the gift. Remember how it was. Remember that the Lord gave you this land. Deuteronomy 8, 11 to 17. Take heed lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes, which I command you this day. Lest when you have eaten and are full and have built goodly houses and live in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply and your silver and gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up and you forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water, who brought you water out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and test you to do you good in the end. Beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. Remember that it comes not from your own work, but from God, the giver. Yes.
Just as a reminder, many of those who are staying there, in reference to what you said, in reference to Guberman's book on the land, he has, I believe, three tapes called the boundary, back to the boundary. It has to do with people of the boundary. And if you're here and you have a chance to listen to the tapes, that's what he talks about. And he says, for the people of Israel at that time, for them to help to remember is to go back to the boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And remember what that wilderness was like
before they entered the promise.
And it's fabulous tapes. I've used them in the adult classes. I have several. I think there's three.
Good. Thank you for that.
If you have a chance to listen to them, you'll just do it.
When was Brueggemann here? Earlier this summer or last year?
Here, I'm going to say 2 to 3 years ago.
Do you know?
2 to 3 years.
2 to 3 years ago.
I don't remember. It was at a joint LCMS joint conference.
Okay.
What's the name of the tape?
Brueggemann, and it has to do with the people at the boundary, or
you can find them under his name, I'm sure, in the index of the tapes. Brueggemann is Brueggemann. Brueggemann. Okay, that's the temptation, always to forget. To forget, and the breaking of the covenant is the forgetting of the conditions of the agreement. This land is yours to care for and to care for you, to meet your needs, as long as you remember the conditions of the covenant. That it is not yours, finally and absolutely, to have and to hold. It is a gift of God. Second theme, the land is the Lord's. Let's develop that a little bit. Leviticus 25:23. This is as opposed to the land being ours to possess in an absolute sense. Leviticus 25:23, very familiar passage. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. Psalm 24, another familiar passage. You can quote it from memory, and I think I can too. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Let me quote from Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, in our own history, said something similar, a similar impact. While the farmer holds the title to the land, actually it belongs to all the people, because civilization itself rests upon the soil. There's a kind of a threefold understanding here of ownership or control of the land. First, the land is God's, the Creator's. In a secondary sense, the land is given to us all collectively. It is given for the use of all of the people of the earth. It's more like the American Indian view of the land as not being something you divide up into parcels and put title to for individuals, but the Indians didn't have any such concept, and that led to all kinds of problems with treaties, down to the present day, in fact. It was a European or Western civilization understanding that you fenced the land off into parcels that were divided up. Most of the world, throughout most of history, has viewed the land more the way the Native American does. It's still true in parts of the world like Africa, where there's a tribal understanding of the ownership of the land. It was true in the or the South Seas, the view of the Hawaiians and the Polynesians was that the land was to be owned that way. So that's a kind of secondary understanding of the land's ownership, that the land is given in a kind of derived sense from the Creator for the use collectively of everybody. And then there's a third sense that I think is where we are today, that the land is assigned for management as a trust or as a stewardship to individuals. But that is not an absolute right to ownership of the land. It is not saying you can do anything you want with the land to which you have title. We get into trouble when people claim that right. Even in contemporary American law, there is no such thing as an absolute right to land. There are always common interests of the whole people that can supersede or overcome that right to property. And some of us resent that because we say it's our land, my land. Well, in an absolute sense, it is not. I think the Homestead Act in our own history is a kind of an illustration of that. The understanding of the Congress was that all of this open land, open in the sense that while occupied by native peoples, in terms of the European occupation of it, it was the possession of the nation as a whole. It was federal land. And it was to be divided up and distributed in small parcels by those who would manage it productively. And they had, it was almost a covenant again, they had the right to farm it if they met certain conditions. Do you remember the conditions? Do you remember the terms of the Homestead Act? A lot of us come from ancestors who originally were homesteaders. I'm sure that's so. What were the terms of the Homestead Act? Did you have to buy the land? You had to live on it, I think, 5 years. The law changed various times, but I think originally it was 5 years. You had to pay a very modest sum, actually.
$1.25 an acre.
And
they had the buildings, and so much of it had
you had to settle it. Yeah.
So much of it had to be worked.
You had to work it.
Tree claims.
This was basically agricultural land, of course, and it had to be turned into productive food-producing land. What else do you remember? What was the typical size of a homestead in acreage?
160 acres.
160, a quarter section, section being 640. So you have, and sometimes you would have half of that and you could make it 80 acres. I remember 80-acre farms in the 30s and 40s. There are still some in the Midwest. With certain kinds of agriculture, you can make a living from 80 acres, though it's increasingly difficult. As you move farther west, you had to have more land to make a living for a family, a full section, maybe two sections. My wife grew up on a farm in South Dakota, which was a whole section of land. And today, her farm is part of another farm, which is two sections, roughly. Well, the Homestead Act had the understanding that the land ultimately belongs to the whole people, but to manage it properly, let me just read a section from this book, Farming the Lord's Land, that makes that point. What has been our kind of national covenant about the land. If the earth belongs to God, and if human beings are mandated to share what they have with one another, then it would seem that the created world is not to be controlled by individuals for their own private purposes, but is the common heritage of all, and should be owned and managed in common. On the other hand, in order to steward the land and to provide for each family, individuals must be assigned specific responsibility for defined areas. In other words, some form of private ownership seems to be essential if the common good is to be served. Now, that's sort of the social compact or contract that we have at this time in America. I think that's the basic understanding that we have, that for the common good to be served, individuals have to be assigned responsibility as stewards for specific portions of the land. But that does not mean that their ownership of it is absolute. We get into trouble when we try to make that stewardship responsibility for a portion of the land that we say is ours by title, when we try to turn that into an absolute. So, the land is not given to individuals, but is a corporate gift to the people in the first place. Yet, responsibility for stewarding it, not owning it, stewarding it, is assigned to individuals. We are caretakers or custodians of that which is assigned to our keeping. There are warnings against concentration of land control in the Bible. The year of Jubilee is one of the provisions, which the people of Israel were given by God, to see to it that the concentration of land, which always seems to happen in any society, you can start out with the land ownership widespread, and through the years, through the generations, fewer and fewer people control more and more of the land. That happens historically in almost every society. And as I said last night, the revolution in China was largely about restoring the control of the land to the largest number of people possible, taking it away from the big landlords. Revolutions in Latin America, more often than not, are about that same issue. Well, there are some who predict that if things continue as they are in the United States, we'll have to have a revolution of the land again someday in the future, a reform of land control patterns to divide it up again and start over. The year of Jubilee, every 50 years in the Old Testament, had that kind of provision. Every 50th year, after a Sabbath of Sabbaths, after 49 years, the 50th year was a year of Jubilee, and one of the provisions then was, because the year of Jubilee was all about starting fresh, starting over, the land should be redistributed back to its original owners, to the families of the original owners. If the original owner had died, well, the descendants, the heirs of the original owner, you'd start over. Now, scholars disagree about whether the year of Jubilee provision was ever actually practiced, but the idea is there. The idea that you start afresh every half century, redistribute the land again to the original owners. If we did that in the United States, who would get the land? The Indians. I mean, there probably were not peoples before the Indians came here, presumably from the Asian continent across the land bridge up in Alaska. But if we practiced that concept, the land would indeed go back to the native peoples who were here before the Europeans came.
Now, don't we have any record at all that that ever happened, that they did that in the Jewish community?
My understanding is, and again, I'm no expert on it, but from what I have read, there is no agreement, there is no evidence.
No record of it.
That doesn't mean it didn't happen, but there's no record that they did practice the provisions of the year of Jubilee. Other provisions were that the prisoners be released from jail, that a year be taken off for learning, for study, for education, and the land was to be fallow. Every seventh year, actually, the land was to be fallow. Yeah, you wonder about all kinds of things like record keeping. Was there a clerk of county courts who kept track of all of that?
Well, they're finding some of those things.
Yes.
All indebtedness.
Yes, it amazes me.
That's right, debts were to be forgiven. So, absolute property rights were not known in the biblical understanding, and yet there was a kind of private ownership of land within the context of the concept that the land is given for all of the people collectively. There was a kind of private ownership assigned to families for their care. So, to summarize this second theme, first, the land is the Lord's. The creator of it is the ultimate owner of the land. In a secondary sense, the land is given to us all collectively for our good. And thirdly, the land is assigned for management as a trust to individuals. A third theme is that the land is the arena for justice and freedom. The land itself, first of all, has rights. The land itself has rights. The land deserves a Sabbath rest. It's not only people who need a Sabbath rest, animals need it. That's said clearly. Your oxen needs a day off. And the land needs it, so that every seventh year, the land was to be rested. It was allowed to lie fallow. Leviticus 25:4. In the seventh year, there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. So that in 6 years, you had to produce enough to take care of seven. It isn't that you fasted for a whole year. You had to produce enough in 6 years to take care of the seventh year.
Couldn't they rotate their pieces of land so, like we do today?
So that not all of the land was retired that seventh year?
20 acres this year, about that rest next year.
Perhaps that's how it was done. I'm not sure. Does anyone know? Were there different schedules so that there was always some land in production? I'm not sure about that. It would make sense, yeah. That may be the way it worked.
To me, that seems logical, and yet it also seems that it skirts the issue of this in Leviticus, because it seems to me this passage in Leviticus not only says the land needs a rest, but it also says that you need to have faith that God will take care of you for that year.
Yeah.
That God will provide for you, and that's why you're doing it. And to set up your rotation so that you always have a feeling coming in, to me, skirts that issue.
That's hedging.
Yeah,
against right. The risk-taking
yeah,
of the
right.
Sabbath. Yeah, yeah. Joel?
I haven't really any direct evidence with regard to this, but the book of Leviticus was a code that accumulated through years, and the Levites really came into prominence after the exile, and it's possible that this was an attempt at that time when Nehemiah and Ezra came back to do something like this and set up that kind of code. So it's possible that that's when it was really tried to be practiced. I don't have any more concrete word than you that it happened, but maybe that's when it really focused, because then it was evident what needed to be done in the way of redistribution.
My guess is that the intention was to follow the pattern that you suggest, Nancy, where all of the land was fallow for
yeah.
you, because the Year of Jubilee idea was that wouldn't be 1/50th every year for 50 years, but the whole society at the same time had a fresh start with the Year of Jubilee.
And on the seventh year, were there not certain festivals, special festivals that then were practiced?
By the whole society, yes, yes. That's my understanding.
Excuse me, just one more comment. I ran across an economist who had an interesting idea which combined some things in ways that I had not thought about before. He said everybody in his economy should have a right to accumulate all they could, but when they died, there was no inheritance.
It all went back to the common
it's kind of the
pot.
Huh? Yeah. Idea from a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
Let me read a paragraph or two from Wendell Berry. Another point about the land's own rights was that the people were not to squeeze from it all the possible production they could, but to husband it gently, not only for their own sake, because that would preserve the land for future generations, but for the sake of the land itself. And Wendell Berry talks about this in his first chapter in today's context in terms of two images of land use. And he confesses that they're, to some extent, caricatures, but they make the point. Let me outline as briefly as I can what seem to be the characteristics of these opposite kinds of mind, attitude toward the land. One is that of the exploiter, one is that of the nurturer. I conceive a strip miner to be a model exploiter. And as a model nurturer, I take the old-fashioned idea or ideal of a farmer. The exploiter is a specialist, an expert. The nurturer is not. The nurturer is a generalist. The standard of the exploiter is efficiency. The standard of the nurturer is care. The exploiter's goal is money, profit. The nurturer's goal is health, his land's health, his own, his family's, his community's, his country's. Whereas the exploiter asks of a piece of land only how much and how quickly it can be made to produce, the nurturer asks a question that is much more complex and difficult. What is its carrying capacity? That is, how much can be taken from it without diminishing it? What can it produce dependably for an indefinite period of time? The exploiter wishes to earn as much as possible by as little work as possible. The nurturer expects, certainly, to have a decent living from his work, but his characteristic wish is to work as well as possible. As well as possible. The competence of the exploiter is in organization. That of the nurturer is in order, a human order, that is, that accommodates itself both to other order and to mystery. The exploiter typically serves an institution or organization. The nurturer serves land, household, community, place. The exploiter thinks in terms of numbers, quantities, hard facts. The nurturer in terms of character, condition, quality, kind.
It would be hard to separate those two thoughts in terms of
home and village and what it used to be. The exploiter could be considered the man for the company, the mining company, that wanted to get all the minerals out if they could. The nurturer,
the people who said you can't pollute the water, you can't cut down the trees, you can't leave it in a mess. But yet the nurturers got their way, and 400 families were left destitute, that is, without anything, but any jobs.
Yeah, without any economic, at least here, economic basis for survival. I think also it has to be said, at least in my mind it has to be said, that farmers can be exploiters. It isn't as though all farmers are nurturers and all miners are exploiters. I think it also is possible that one can mine the earth in a nurturing way. One can try to restore the earth as much as possible. The evidence isn't all in on that. Whether you can strip mine and return the earth, absent the minerals you took, whether you can return the earth to the condition it was in for other purposes. There is some evidence we're trying to do it, and new laws are more rigorous and require that, and you know, in parts of Montana and Wyoming now, we're trying to see if that is possible. But I guess I would have to say that I think, just as you can be a farmer and exploit the earth, you can mine the soil, using it up, so you could also mine the soil for minerals and be a nurturer of the earth. It is at least within the realm of possibility. I don't think Barry is suggesting, and I wouldn't want to suggest, that all farmers are nurturers and all miners are exploiters. But he tends to lift them up as the examples of the two types. He says the farmer in the old-fashioned idea or ideal of farming, because a lot of his book deals with an attack upon the way we're farming today, which he says is exploitive and not good for the long-term care of the earth or for people in the long term. So the land has its own rights. The land will serve us only insofar as we serve it. So we must be servants of the land if we want the land to be servant to us. But in the second place, land is also that arena where the rights of all get attention. The land is to bear fruit for those who are landless. And in the biblical record, who are the landless? Who are mentioned over and over again as people without land who have rights to the fruit of the land? Who can you think of?
The priests.
The Levites did not share in the distribution of the land, and they are cared for through the tithe. Who else? Who was without land in that day? Yeah, but why? Why were you poor? At least one reason why you were poor had to do with life circumstance.
Illness.
Yeah, but other reasons.
Widows
and orphans. The widow did not own land, and orphans were landless. And who else was dependent, at least for a time, on the land?
The foreigner.
The foreigner, the alien, the sojourner, the one who traveled through the land, had a right to be cared for by the fruit of the land, to have needs met. So the widow, the orphan, the sojourner, the law of gleaning was one of the provisions for that. And that was mentioned earlier this week by somebody. Joe, I think you mentioned that as an early form of welfare. The people had a right to sustenance from the land. Ruth and Naomi are an illustration of that. Sojourners traveling through the land had a right to harvest and eat from the food that was left, because harvesting wasn't to be terribly efficient. If you got every last kernel, that was wrong, because then there would be nothing for those who depended on the gleaning of what was left in the fields.
Chuck, maybe you're getting around to it, but it seems to be an issue, at least one issue that I grapple with, is that we look at the biblical record, about care of the land and stewardship, and yet, at least in biblical times, the people who owned the land, who did the farming, were your wealthy, affluent people. Whereas it seems to me that in our day, the people who farm the land, at least from my perspective, are pretty much the powerless, whom economic factors are put upon them, which makes them many times be the persons who are exploiting the land simply because of...
To survive. Yeah, they have to become exploiters. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, are you getting to that?
I hope we'll get to it. We may not get...
Okay.
We probably won't finish, but I want to get to the issue of growth in farm size. Do you have to get big or get out? which is a basic question for American agriculture today. And I would agree that many of the smaller family farmers are among the oppressed of our economy. They are not getting a fair shake, and they feel trapped, and they have to do certain kinds of farming practices in order to make it at all, which they know are not good. At the same time, there are many large holders of land in our country, whether they're farming the land or absentee owners of it, who are very powerful and maybe a part of the oppressive system. So it's both and, I think. And all of those varieties go under the label family farmer. What is a family farmer today? A family operation can be very vast and big and very remunerative, or very small and just eking out an existence. Let me push along to see if we can finish and get into some of the current problems in agriculture and some possibilities for dealing with them. Amos 8, 4 to 6, I want to refer to under the category of the land and justice. Amos 8. I think this is probably also a quite familiar passage. Hear this, you who trample upon the needy and bring the poor of the land to an end, saying, when will the new moon be over that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath that we may offer wheat for sale, that we may make the ephah small and the shekel great, and deal deceitfully with false balances, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, and sell the refuse of the wheat. The land is not to be used for aggrandizement, and the product of the land is not to be used to give small measure and great price. Isaiah 5 to 8 says something similar. This is a part of that allegory in Isaiah about the vineyard. Let me sing for my beloved a song, a love song concerning his vineyard. It's a story the prophet tells to depict the breaking of the covenant, the faithlessness of the people. Toward the end of it, this passage: woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is no more room, and you are made to dwell alone in the midst of the land. Seems to be a word there about concentration of land ownership and control. And in Micah 2, the first two verses: woe to those who divide wickedness and work evil upon their beds. When the morning dawns, they perform it, because it is in the power of their hand. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them away. They oppress a man and his house, a man and his inheritance. Land is to be used, not used up. It is to be cultivated, not mined. René Dubos, in The Wooing of the Earth, another new book about the relationship between people and land, René Dubos, D-U-B-O-S, argues that human beings are not just destroyers of land. It is not all a negative picture, the way people have used the land, but can also enrich the environment. And he points out, and I agree with this, that the humanly altered landscape is often an improvement on raw nature. I wouldn't say the tailings are for us today, but he argues that a rolling field of wheat or a pasture dotted with cattle is an improvement on raw nature, the land left without those things, without the wheat growing there or without the cattle grazing on the land, and that those things can happen without destroying the land. In fact, they're an improvement of the land. I think we need to keep that in mind, too, amid all the talk of environmental destruction, which is a major concern for our time. Well, those three themes from the Bible are among the major ones on the land. The land as gift, the land as belonging ultimately to the Lord and not to us, we are stewards of it, and the land as an arena for freedom and justice to be worked out. Now let me turn to the second half in the time remaining and suggest that we have some problems related to all of these themes, and we need to develop wise public policies, wise ways of going into the future as a people. And I'm talking primarily about the United States, though some of this by extension applies to the whole human family. I want to mention specifically three problems that I see. There are many others. One is the increasing concentration of ownership of land, of agricultural land in particular, in our society. The second is the loss of farmland to non-farm uses. The loss of farmland to non-farm uses, which I think is a problem if only because the world needs more farmland, not less, in the future, because it needs more food. And thirdly, the manner of farming in the United States and the whole area of soil conservation, how we conserve the soil, how we farm it so that it is nurtured rather than used up. Some data on the first problem. The number of farms in the U.S. is down from about 7 million individually owned farms in the 1930s to 2.3 million today. We have about one-third the number of farm operations that we had in the 1930s. Now, I don't argue that we should have maintained 7 million. I think some consolidation was necessary. There were a lot of small, not really full-time farms in the 7 million. But I also feel that we're getting to the point where we have too few. Why do I say that? I say that because the number of people living on the land today is the smallest it's ever been since Europeans came here, and it is still shrinking. And that is not, I think, healthy, both in terms of a dispersed ownership of land and in terms of the survival of rural communities. Rural communities increasingly find it difficult to survive with their institutions intact because the people simply aren't there. And that's education, that's health care, that's the church, it's institutions of all kinds that you need for community. How many people live on the land today, and how many are, well, let me say it another way. How many, what percentage of Americans is engaged in agriculture? Do you know? It's under 4% now. It's down to about 3.5, 3.8%, and still shrinking. That means what? A little over, I suppose, about 8 million people out of 200 and some. Yeah. Where have those farms gone, those 4 or 5 million that have disappeared? What has happened to them? They've become part of other farms. That's right. Most of the farm sale, the sale of farms in the United States, is to other farmers, neighboring farmers.
Well, they can do so much more with the equipment that they have. I grew up on a farm. I knew just everything about a farm. And they can do so much more now than they could in my day when I was there. They can farm so many more acres and very comfortably with the tools that
right,
they have.
Right.
So if you have a small farm, you need the same kind of tools, yet they cost an astronomical amount, and yet you have to have them. And this is the reason a small farmer can't make it.
The way we farm requires that farms be of a certain size to pay for the capitalization. That's right. Which raises a question that we'll come to in a moment, I think, if we get to it. Is the way we farm part of the problem? That is, do we have to stop the tendency toward more and more energy intensity, more and more use of big machines in farming, or can that trend go on forever? I think it cannot. And many farmers agree that we've about reached the limit of how far you can go in energy intensity and machinery intensity in agriculture.
I think there could be an awful lot of more cooperativeness among the farmers.
Okay, that's maybe some return to the old image of the threshing machine, where not every farmer owned all the equipment him or herself that you shared. And that's another thing that we can look at, and some farmers are beginning to talk about. But you know that farmers are a very independent lot in every culture, always have been, and like to be totally self-sufficient. Don't like to depend on the neighbor. Despite the tradition of the threshing machine, farmers today would rather use the combine for many reasons, and I think one is that independence and feeling that you're self-sufficient.
In the CBS News, probably a month and a half ago, a statement by the IRS said that farmers were ranchers in Wyoming who shared work back and forth should report the work that other people did for them because it was taxable.
Part of their income.
And they should be paying tax on it. And it just made me so angry because, you know, you can't even help your neighbor anymore without reporting it to the IRS.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that this is part of the system that we're talking about that constantly is saying no to agriculture.
And tax policies is one whole area of concern because tax policies tend to support consolidation, growth, bigness, rather than the survival of the smaller operation. Well, there are some pressures there have been, and I think supported by the land-grant colleges and by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which are now being reassessed by those folks, whether or not they've done the right thing promoting bigness in agriculture. Paul Johnson, who's a Lutheran former editor of Farm Publications, wrote one of the chapters in this book, and he says, he confesses that he's been part of that too, promoting bigness, and now he's having second thoughts. Here's what he writes in part. During the last generation, we have been more or less committed to the inevitability of large machinery, high energy input, large fields, elimination of fence rows and windbreaks, specialization in crops or livestock, and heavy use of fertilizers and weed killers. This trend has been based on three premises. One, substituting technology for human labor is good. Whenever you can save labor by using machines, that's a good thing. Two, economies of scale go on forever. That's one of the assumptions, that if it's good to be a little bit bigger, it's even better to be much bigger, that economies of scale continue forever. Well, research is now showing that that's not the case. You reach a certain point in size in agriculture, and there are no further economies of scale to be derived. Three, the premise that problems of farming can be met indefinitely by increasing research and applied science, that technology and science can always come up with an answer for any problem. Well, he goes on to question all three of those assumptions. It is amazing what confidence we have had in the idea that we can always meet our problems by pouring on more technology and energy. Of course, when energy was cheap, it was easier to reason that way than it is today. Low prices are met with higher and higher yields on the theory that it is the extra 10 bushels per acre that make the difference between loss and profit. Instead of holding off on fertilizer when surpluses are piling up, we fertilize at even higher rates to get more yield than the next guy in order to make it. Every threat of insect damage or disease is met with more and better chemicals, which of course add materially to the cash cost of doing business. The cost of inputs is increased. When insects or diseases develop immunity to our chemicals, we increase the rate of application and urge scientists to come up with new chemicals to keep us ahead of the pests. Well, I think that chapter, you can go on and on. It's kind of a confession by someone who's had second thoughts of the error of his ways earlier when he was part of that movement toward getting big or getting out. There are some policy options, it seems to me, for us to address the problem of concentration of land ownership. One is, and this is being talked about seriously for the 1981 Farm Bill, every 4 years in the United States we rewrite or readopt the omnibus farm legislation. 1981 is that time. So the debate is now on. We'll be in the new session of Congress. One seriously considered proposal is to put a ceiling on price supports beyond a certain level, a certain volume of production, or a certain number of acres a given farmer would not receive government price supports, government subsidies. Farmers don't like to talk about that as welfare, but it is welfare in the sense that public assistance programs of other kinds are welfare. Bailing out Chrysler is welfare. It is a subsidy from public funds. And there is serious consideration to putting a ceiling on that so that the bigger farmer, who doesn't need the help from tax dollars, will not get it beyond a certain level of production. Secondly, legislation to assist new farmer entry into farming. It is estimated that in the Midwest today, it takes capitalization of $250,000 to start farming. That's the amount of money you have to begin farming. Land and machinery cost. Most people, unless they inherit a farm, can't do that. So a lot of states are addressing this problem. Minnesota, Iowa, other Midwest states have already adopted legislation to use public assistance to help new farmers get started, usually by insuring the loan, because they are not a good enough risk with the private lending agencies. The state backs the loan and insures the loan. A third option that is more controversial and is not yet enacted anywhere, but is being talked about seriously in North Dakota, is a progressive land tax, graduated land tax for agricultural land. Now, what does that say to you when you hear that term? Do you know what that is talking about? A graduated or progressive land tax.
Ralph Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah, but how would it work? Or what would it be like?
The more land you have, the more...
Yeah, it's like the graduated income tax. The more income you have, the higher rate you pay. That's the way it's supposed to work anyway. Though if you're very rich, you seem to have ways of avoiding that.
It seems that
This approach would say, and it's been advocated in a little pamphlet written up by an ALC layman who's the Commissioner of Taxation in North Dakota, Byron Dorgan. He's currently running for the House, I think, House of Representatives from North Dakota. It's called the Progressive Land Tax, and it argues that after a certain level, whatever level you agree to as a state for your land tax on agricultural land, beyond that level, then for additional acreage under one ownership, you'd pay 105% of the rate, and then 110%, and then 115%, and on up, just as with income tax. It would not prohibit larger holdings of land, but it would say you're going to have to pay taxes on it at a higher rate, property taxes. I think that's something that we ought to examine. I think that would tend to discourage the aggregation of land into larger and larger holdings because you'd have to pay more tax on it.
He'd have to. Would that also have an effect on pushing up the price of that?
Well, you'd think so, except that the farmer doesn't set the price. The farmer is probably, in the market economy, the farmer, the producer of a raw material, is still a true capitalist, is truly subject to market forces. I'm talking about the family farm operation, where they take price, not set a price. They take the market price for what they produce. I don't think so. I think it's generally true that the producer of a raw material, like a farm product, is still subject largely to market forces and has very little control over the price for the bushel of wheat. That's right. The irony is that everybody else who deals with that product after it leaves the farmer's gate can set the price. The transporter can say, I have to get this much to haul the wheat to market. The packager, the baker, they can all take the price it costs them to acquire it in whatever form and then add on what they did to it and say, this is the price to the next person along the chain. But the original producer can't do that. So I don't think that the producer, whereas the builder of an automobile can do that, can say the cost of production of this car goes up as the cost of the energy and the materials goes up. The farmer has not been able to do that. And that's one reason why a lot of smaller farmers are in trouble, because their cost of production has been going up, but the cost of the commodity has not. In fact, the wheat price has been coming down in recent years. So
I was wondering what would happen if the big farmer would say, okay, one way to get around this, I'll leave this much to my wife, this much to my son. I maybe have a couple of sons. And
playing games with the intent of the law.
Know, yeah. That's possible.
Yeah.
So there are ways to get
around. Oh, yeah.
We have another problem in our area where we live now. I grew up in Nebraska on a farm, and I was there until I was married. And so I know quite a bit about farming in the Midwest. But in our area, we live in the Seattle area now. We have a nice valley there that had been for years and years been used as an truck farming area.
Yeah.
Very fertile area. Industry is coming in now and building on these areas. Well, the areas are not being used for farmers. Why? That is, farmers are not using it as farms. Because people are going to Boeing, they're going to all these industries and working there. They can make easier money. The work is a lot easier than the farm work is. So the farms are laying idle with nothing, with weeds growing and so on.
Yep.
And we're having a hard time keeping people on the farm to farm these places.
Especially when the economic return is not nearly what they can get from industry.
No.
That's another part. You have to really love the lifestyle.
That's
and
right.
Be willing to take a lower income.
And only the Japanese, most as a rule, are the ones that are still on these farms and doing the hard work and a lot of the manual work which it requires to farm these areas.
You've given me a transition to the next problem area that I want to talk about, and one of my illustrations of how to deal with it is King County. I don't know how familiar you are with that, but King County has addressed, that's the Seattle County, the problem of preserving what is left of farmland in farming in an urban, a highly urbanized area. So the second problem area is the loss of farmland to non-farm uses.
They did it by passing a bond issue to raise $10 million to pay the farmers not to sell their land to developers.
Yeah, to buy the development rights,
yeah.
The non-agricultural rights to the land, to buy that from the farmers and pay them for it with the agreement that it would be kept in farming.
Instead of reducing the tremendous taxes that the farmers were having to pay and letting them farm their land as they want to farm it,
yeah.
They're going to buy privilege
There are two approaches. You apparently have questions about that approach. I think that's one approach to be explored. It's been working well in Long Island for about 20 years. The other approach is to tax the land solely on the basis of agricultural return and not on its potential subdivision value. Because if you tax it on its subdivision value, the farmer has to sell it for subdivision. Can't pay the taxes. Okay. Let me.
Right, you said that that's a little bit of an answer. You said we're talking earlier about small communities and what happens to them. And that's a little bit of what happens to small communities that used to be have small farms or small agricultural, you know, around it. They are becoming bedroom communities. I serve in the town of Young, which is by Olympia, Tumwater, their homeland, up in Seattle, who drove over 50 miles. And the school district went from A to double A. These little small farms went to divided up into residential, and we became a bedroom community to serve the bigger cities. The little farmers then were slowly fading out. A lot of them did work on their own and came back and did homegrown farming on the side.
Let me say before you drift away that there are on the table back there some materials that you're welcome to pick up. The only thing that you shouldn't take are the books, which are from the library, but all of the quantity materials you may take along. We're not going to be able to finish, obviously. Let me just mention that the other problem, in addition to the loss of farmland to non-farm uses, the other problem for our society that I want to address is the style of farming, the way we farm. The energy intensity, the chemical intensity, the use of monocropping approaches rather than diversified agriculture, and how some of our farm people are looking at that today and what they propose to do about it in terms of changing practices. I would say our society needs to have three broad objectives as we look at the future of American farm policy. One is to keep people on the land, to adopt policies that help people stay on the land who want to stay in farming. Secondly, to keep land itself in agricultural use. We can't afford to retire 3 million acres a year from farming uses to other uses, and that's currently what we're doing. For highways, for urban development, even for flooding it with reservoirs, damming up the rivers and flooding it for water supply. There are competing uses, all of which may be good, but I think we simply have to keep as much land in agricultural use as we can. And then the third broad objective should be to care gently for the land as we do farm it, as we use it, to use farming procedures that nurture it rather than exploit it. In Iowa, where I grew up, the estimate today is that half of the topsoil that was there 120 years ago is now gone. So 120 years of farming in Iowa, probably the richest region for agriculture in America, has been used up in 120 years. Well, does the next 120 years use up the other 50% and then we quit farming in Iowa? We've got to somehow change our ways of farming so that we don't use up the soil that fast. And farmers are beginning to discover that, but the pressure of economics has forced them into many practices that they know are bad just to survive.
Well, it blew away there in the 20s, as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, and then we adopted soil conservation practices that dealt with that, and then we abandoned them again in the 50s and 60s.
But you know, they are, so as I go back now, they are diversifying their crops there. That is raising all different crops that I had never seen before in the Middle West when I grew up. But they're raising now to, raise other things on,
yeah,
to rotate and so on and so forth, which is all good for the soil.
But it's still in Iowa. When I was growing up, there was a lot more crop rotation than there is today. Today, it's monocropping most of the state, corn, soybean all the time. And the diversified farming, which includes livestock and crops, and you put the livestock waste back on the land as part of the fertilizer, that's decreasing, not increasing.
Right. Yeah. Well, see, the farmer's getting the same way like everybody else. That's hard work.
It is. It is harder work. It takes more. And it's
absolutely kicks muscles.
it if you have animals, you have to be around more.
Sure,
you can't take off in the winter.
No,
and I suppose it's not good for non-farmers to tell farmers how they ought to do it. I understand all of that. Yet farmers themselves are starting to say, we've got to get back to diversified agriculture because it cares for the land.
This is the way my father farmed anyway, and I know now my brothers, of course, they're not farming like that anymore,
yeah,
either. They're
during the Depression, they lived off the hay.
Well, thank you, people. It's lunchtime.
Thank you very much.